I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
I asked her, could she breathe? And she shook her head, yes. I told her, I will be back to untie her. I left, went got the money, and came back to untie her and let her go. I called her, and she did not move.
These are the written words of Texas inmate number 35643, Philip Tompkins. They're taken from letters he wrote to us across 3 years, in which he gave consent for his story to be told. During our research for this podcast, we were notified that Tompkins had died in prison in June 2020 after complications with coronavirus. My name is Zoe Hines, and Philip Tompkins is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Ned Parker and I have corresponded with in our work as documentary producers.
Hey, 911.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 5, Accidental Homicide.
It's 2018, and I'm in Texas interviewing a prisoner on death row. His victim died in the hospital after surgical complications. I didn't kill her, the hospital did, he explains. I'm not a murderer. But what put her in that hospital was a bullet from his gun. This week's case doesn't feature the violence of a gun attack. Instead, the murder weapon was simply a piece of rag being used to silence the victim. But the result was just as deadly. The difference between manslaughter and murder is a question of criminal intent. But buried somewhere within the chain of cause and effect, intent can be tricky to define and even harder to prove. Different countries, and in the US, different states, have different punishments to fit different definitions. But for me personally, one thing never changes. It's always difficult to listen to an inmate convicted of murder fail to acknowledge any connection between their actions, however much they blame the gun, the car, the hospital, or even a poorly positioned piece of rag, and the loss of an innocent life.
The district attorney, police, etc., said I intentionally killed my victim. And that's a damn lie.
Tell us about our letter writer for this episode, Ned, Philip Tompkins. What questions and themes do his letters raise?
Well, we've called this episode Accidental Homicide because Philip Tompkins was convicted of a murder which he claims was an accident. In his letters to us, he recalls the events of that murder in graphic detail, and whether the death was accidental or not is very much up for debate. But this is a claim that we've heard a lot in our investigations, the default position of many people who are responsible for committing murder is more likely than not to claim that they didn't mean to, it wasn't intentional. But as documentary makers, we are in a position where we're not operating a trial, so we're not looking for a binary outcome of innocent or guilty in a legal sense. But ultimately, we and the viewers of the films are constantly making judgments about the individuals we investigate. And I guess what we're all probably doing is making an assessment on if we feel that they are morally culpable of taking a life. So culpability is really one of the main themes here. But another theme that plays a part in Philip Tompkins' trial, which you'll hear when we get to the verdict, is the experience of African Americans in the American judicial system. Now, obviously, that is a huge topic, but it is something which we will touch on in part in this episode, very much based upon the claims and accusations made by Philip Tompkins himself about what his experiences were.
Before we explore the letters of Philip Tompkins, let's hear the tragic events of his case file.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. January 1981, Houston, Texas. 27-year-old Philip Tompkins is en route to his ex-girlfriend's house to borrow money. He's driving his car while high on marijuana and failing to stop at a red light, accidentally bumps the rear end of a car in front of him. The driver, 24-year-old pharmacist Mary Diana Berry, exits her vehicle to survey the damage. As she gets out of her car, Tompkins spies her handbag and demands that she gives him any money she has. Berry hands over just $14. Fearing a confrontation, Berry offers to lead Tompkins to her local bank branch, where she would withdraw him more cash. Tompkins demands to know her bank card details. Then, Tompkins abducts Berry and drives her to a remote, wooded location where he ties her to a tree and stuffs parts of a bedsheet in her mouth. Tompkins leaves her tied up and heads to a local bank branch to withdraw money from her account. On his return to the woodland, Mary Diana Berry has suffocated.
We were writing to Tompkins in relation to our Netflix series, I'm a Killer, and I think he took some exceptions to that. He seemed to be willing to participate and to take part, but he did want to object about the idea of being labelled a killer himself.
From his very first letter to us, Tompkins displays some anxiety about being identified as a killer. Quotes from Tompkins' letters are read by an actor, but this is what he had to say to us.
I don't like the title of the documentary, I Am a Killer. I am not a cold-blooded killer, and the title makes one seem like he, she is, and boasting about it. And that's not me. I did recklessly cause the death of someone, but the person's death was accidentally reckless, not intentionally done. I did not intend to kill the person.
Well, I do think it's worth noting that we've made a deliberate choice of the words with the title of the documentary series. It's not I am a murderer, it is I am a killer, and that reflects the fact that we're talking to people who are responsible for having taken another person's life. They have killed, but we're not calling them murderers, even though that is legally what they are, because the word murderer is just far more loaded with intent, in my opinion.
The title I am a killer isn't sensationalist when you break it down. It's a statement of fact, but I can see how it could be read another way. So I do understand the need to explain that as responsible filmmakers, we're looking to unpack what that phrase actually means, as opposed to asking killers to boast, if we're using Tompkins' terminology, about what they've done. If anything, we want to get away from as much sensationalisation as possible and look at the story behind the crime. After displaying this initial caution over the title of our series, Tompkins was happy to talk to us. So let's return to his letters. He started at the beginning with his upbringing in Virginia and New Jersey.
There was good days and there was bad days. I grew up thinking that my mother hated me because she always beat the hell out of me. And in return, I hated her and did things she did not like, which resulted in more beating. When I got older, I came to know she didn't hate me. She beat me because she wanted me to do right things, not wrong things. In the end, she showed she loved me a lot, and I grew to love her.
Tompkins tells us about how his mother and father broke up and how he came to feel responsible for her.
She vowed never to give up on us. She worked damn hard to put food on the table, clothes on our back. I could see her pain, her suffering. But she kept going. I told her I was going to quit school to help her. She told me I was not. She wanted us to finish school. I went to school until I was 14. I quit to help her.
He then explains how he began saving money to give to his mother, and that this might have been the catalyst for beginning a life of crime.
I went to work on my uncle's farm, making $20 a week. I would try to give her the $20 so she can save it to buy her home, but she told me she did not want my money, whatever amount of money I made. I always gave her half. I went to New Jersey when I was 14 years old to make more money, but things didn't work out as I wanted to. I got into crime, stealing, and got caught, and went to jail. She would come to visit me and told me one day when I came home, she would have a surprise for me. Her surprise was, she had gotten her own home finally. She never gave up. Her dream was my dream.
These first extracts from Tomkins' letters do sit uneasily with me. There's this whole sort of female focus. He spends a significant amount of time talking about his mother being a driven woman with a dream and about recognising that her violent abuse was born out of love, which in itself is an uncomfortable apologist's perspective. Is this him asking the reader to think differently about how he feels about women with this story?
Does it feel to you that this is a conscious thing that he's doing? Is he placing his regard for women in his life kind of front and foremost in these letters in order to make us feel that he's not somebody who had a disregard for women and was happy to rob them viciously?
I think it will be interesting to see how his letters continue and whether that theme persists. How does he frame the women he speaks about, and is that coming across as intentional? What's leading him to articulate himself in this way?
Let's return to Tomkins' letters, where he writes about the fact that we're not the only people who've been receiving letters from this killer. Turns out he's been corresponding with two pen pals, and he writes about the impact that their letters have had on his life. He talks about being saved by two people from opposite sides of the world, Michigan, USA, and Suffolk in England.
I tried to run them off, but they told me they was not going nowhere. They were here with me to stay, my friend to the end. They was both Christians, child of God, and I was a friend of the devil. They did not come to take from me, but to give. I was hungry, and they gave me God's words to eat, and I was full. I was cold and naked, and they clothed me in their love, and I felt warm. I was poor, and they gave me riches, wealth of a different kind. They brought me out of the darkness into light. They took me from the devil and gave me back to God. They gave me the will to live. They gave me the strength to carry on. They took my hand and walked through the valley of shadow of death, Death Row, with me. 30 years later, they are still in my life. I call them my angels. And they are.
This section of his letter doesn't directly relate to his case, but I do think it's really interesting to hear this from a prisoner who is on death row, because someone who is going to spend the rest of their life in prison, there's not many things that they can obtain. They can't have many properties. And a pen pal is a commodity with a value to an inmate. It's a relationship.
These guys are often in the same room for decades. All of their interaction with other humans has been stripped back to other criminals, the odd visit from family if they're lucky, and correctional facility staff. And we do see inmates building real, long-term, heartfelt, in-depth connections with people via letter.
Somebody in Tomkins' situation has had longer than most people to be able to sit and contemplate their life. They've had time to think about their actions. And that's why it's a privilege to read their version of events and their story in a letter.
These are the letters from the pens of prisoners. Letters from a killer.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. They're an online counselling service that will assess your personal needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp is not a crisis line or self-help. It's therapy at your fingertips. Professional counselling done securely online.
Visit their website and read the testimonials that are posted daily. Here are some success stories. Dr. Baylor has been incredibly patient and understanding. She sends messages of encouragement and support throughout the week and is always willing to give you advice when your anxiety or depression is overwhelming. Very flexible and understanding with schedules. Glad I found her. Also, Through respect, honesty, care, compassion, and professionalism, Joshua takes on a coach-like role, listening, offering up sage advice and practical therapeutic techniques and practices. Thank you, Joshua. Your help is truly appreciated.
BetterHelp is available wherever you are in the world, and you can start communicating with a licensed professional therapist in under 48 hours. You can log into your account at betterhelp.com anytime and send a message to your counsellor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions.
BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counsellors if needed. And it's more affordable than traditional offline counselling. Financial aid is also available.
Visit betterhelp.com to read more and join over a million people who've taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and listeners to Letters from a Killer will get 10% off their first month when they visit betterhelp.com/LFAK. Let's return to Tompkins' letters. Here he begins to talk about the events of the crime itself. As we said earlier, while he freely admits that he was guilty, he continues to reiterate that the homicide was accidental.
I am guilty of the crime, but not as I was charged. I will tell you what honestly happened. They, the district attorney, police, etc., said I intentionally killed my victim, and that's a damn lie. I did not intend to kill her. I really did not set out to rob her. Until things happened.
Tompkins describes how he and his girlfriend had lost their jobs. She was fired for beating up a co-worker after a racist incident. Now they were both out of money, overspent at Christmas, and his girlfriend was considering walking the streets.
I told her no, I did not want her to do nothing like that. I told her I will take care of it. She told me, don't do nothing crazy. My true intention was to go and get the money from my ex-girlfriend, who was a drug dealer, and she always had a lot of money and drugs around her house. If she did not get or loan me the money, because I left her for my new girlfriend, I was going to take and rob her for the money.
Tompkins begins to write about the events of the murder, and he does so in graphic detail. The version of events is very similar to our case file, but it's told now from his perspective, and he writes what becomes a highly detailed account. He describes how he was on his way to his ex-girlfriend's house when he dropped a joint he was smoking whilst at a red light, and then he hit the car in front. The driver allegedly accused him of being drunk, and this is where Tompkins would make the decision that would ultimately lead him to death row.
She had her handbag with her, and honestly, I thought about taking her money. I don't know what got into me. I grabbed her handbag and told her to give me her money.
Unfortunately for the victim, Mary Diana Berry, she only had $14 on her when Tompkins crashed into the back of her car. Allegedly, she pleaded with him, saying she had more in the bank, and suggested that she lead him to her local branch.
I told her I was not going to follow her nowhere. She might get away and call the police. So I started taking her to my car and put her in my car. I told her I was not going to hurt her. Just tell me where her bank is at and how to use her bank card. She told me everything. She told me to let her go. I told her I was not going to let her go now, because if I do, she was going to go to the police. So I drove off with her in my car. While driving away, what was going through my mind? If I take her to the bank with me, and if a cop was there, she was going to make a scene, and the cop was going to get me. So I decided not to take her to the bank. I told her I was going to take her somewhere and tie her up until I go to the bank and get the money. She told me, okay. I took her to this woody place I knew and tied her up to a tree and placed a cloth in her mouth so she could not call for help. I asked her, could she breathe? And she shook her head, yes. I told her, I will be back to untie her. I left. Went, got the money, and came back to untie her and let her go. When I got where she was, I called her, and she did not move. I raised up her head and let it go, and it fell back to the ground. I was getting scared. I checked her pulse and could not feel a beat on her wrist. I really got scared and started crying, because I knew she had died.
This description is detailed, and that detail is telling, in my opinion. The moments Tompkins recounts in this extract are moments that only he and the deceased could testify to. They are details of a conversation that we will never be able to corroborate, and as a result, I think it's interesting that he chooses to include their back and forth.
And if you believe in his words, it does feel as though this was not a well thought through crime in any way. This could have been just simply a spur of the moment, opportunistic robbery that led to something more sinister. But I have also read in further accounts from the police that they believe that Tompkins intentionally rammed the victim's car. We can't verify if this is true or not, but I definitely get a feeling from Tompkins' perspective in his letters that this is almost a farcical attempt at a crime.
Most notably for me in this passage, bearing in mind we've got a man here who claims this death was an accident, he's chosen to include the fact that he asked her if she could breathe.
I asked her, could she breathe? And she shook her head, yes.
And he took that as an acknowledgement that she could.
I told her, I will be back to untie her.
He's been accused of killing her by not taking care. And so here he is including this line, I think probably quite consciously, as if to say, no, look, I checked on her. I checked if she was okay. And to me, that does feel suspicious. And the other point that really got me was this phrase.
I started taking her to my car and put her in my car.
It's a listed description. It's A followed by B.
There were really passively written couple of sentences, but they brush over so much and they leave you asking, how did you take her to your car? How did you put her in your car? Is he physically picking her up and carrying her? Is he forcefully kidnapping Mary Diana Berry? Is he dragging her by the arm? It begs a lot of questions. And then he also writes this sentence.
I told her I was not going to hurt her.
Did she know that? She must have been absolutely terrified. You can just visualize what's actually happening here. What he's describing is a horrifying event, but the way that he writes it feels like he's really minimalizing the impact of what is actually happening.
The whole event seems chaotic. The way that he's articulating what happened is surfing such an interesting line between abstract ambiguity and minute detail.
Letters from a killer. The verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. On Monday, June 15th, 1981, a Harris County jury convicted Tompkins of capital murder, sentencing him to death by lethal injection for the intentional killing of a person during a robbery and kidnapping. In 1990, his sentence was commuted to life by Governor Bill Clements.
The robbery and the kidnapping elevated the offence to capital murder, which is basically the shorthand for a murder which warrants the death penalty. And in most states, the act of killing someone whilst undertaking another crime will elevate that crime to a capital offence. And in this case with Tompkins, he has admitted to a robbery and he has also admitted to a kidnapping. And that therefore makes this a capital crime.
But in his letter to us, Tompkins has a few things to say about whether he thinks his case should qualify as capital.
The district attorney charged me with capital murder, which carried the death penalty. I did kidnap her, did take her money. I am not guilty of intentionally killing her, and they knew it. Her death was an accident.
To what degree is Tompkins culpable for this death?
He's entirely culpable for this death. If he hadn't robbed Mary Diana Berry, kidnapped her, and put a rag in her mouth, she would be alive today.
We learned she died from suffocation. I did not deliberately kill her. I was not a cold, bloody murderer, as they made me out to be. I never harmed anyone in my life. I am not a violent person.
I think this comes back to his initial concern over the title of the series that we were hoping to interview him for, which was I Am a Killer, and his insistence that he was not a killer. However tragically, he has killed someone, maybe not intentionally, but certainly through his own reckless acts. As we heard in the verdict, Philip Tompkins was initially sentenced to death. And we do have to ask ourselves, to what degree is a death sentence the right form of punishment for a crime of this nature, or for any crime? but certainly a crime here which has so many question marks over the culpability and intent. And there's also another question which we come to, which is, would everybody be sentenced to death in this same situation? In his letters to us, Tompkins comments on what he perceives as the racism that played a part in his initial conviction.
And he continues to talk about the prejudice he faced in relation to his processing by the justice system.
Back in the 80s, the white people here in Texas did not like to see a white woman with a black man. And if she was with a black man, she was white trash. Honestly, I did not know what prejudice or racism was until I came to Texas. I am from the South. I knew black and white people was fighting in the South. I thought they was fighting because black wanted equal rights. I honestly did not know it was cause of the color of a person's skin. It don't make sense to me that a person hates someone because he is black or white. I honestly believe that racism played a part in my crime, that I was discriminated against because I was black and my victim was white.
America, and particularly the South of America, has such a vast and complex history in terms of racial prejudice.
If you are an African-American man, you are five times more likely to be sent to prison than if you're a Caucasian American man. It is clearly not an equal system. And we hear this a lot when we are writing to African-American prisoners. They feel that race often has played a part in their conviction. And it's very hard to know the truth of it. Certainly, I don't feel that we're really qualified through our personal life experiences to know necessarily what that sort of racism might look or feel like. So I would be very cautious in making any sort of judgment here. But there is certainly one very significant point that comes up in Tompkins' case here, which for me is extremely worrying. And it's about the jury who convicted him.
Tompkins was convicted by an all-white jury. And for me, it's impossible to look at Tompkins' letters and his reflections on race in isolation without considering what happened in the courtroom. In 1987, he filed an unsuccessful motion to the Court of Criminal Appeals, which argued that the prosecution's peremptory striking of seven black jurors was unfair. So to explain that, this means that during his trial, seven of the black jurors that had been selected to hear the case were denied a place on the jury. They were struck off and replaced by a jury who statistically were more likely to find Tompkins guilty.
Jury trials are a cornerstone of many judicial systems across the world. And the concept, of course, is that your case is being judged by a selection of your peers. This is what happens in the UK, where a jury is composed of 12 randomly selected people from the area in which the crime took place. But in the US, the jury system does play out pretty differently. The prosecution and the defence each have a chance to disqualify jury members.
I think of it in terms of the difference between being drafted, which is the UK version, you're called up arbitrarily, whereas in the US, it's an audition process, you're selected. They call it jury selection, and as you say, prosecutors and defence attorneys pick their team. Essentially, they pick the people who they think will be sympathetic to their respective arguments.
And during this process, the prosecutors managed, in Philip Tompkins' case, to select 12 people who were all white.
I honestly believe that racism played a part in my crime, that I was discriminated against because I was black.
For justice to function, it has to be beyond reproach. It has to be a fair, or as fair as it can be, assessment of a crime.
When it comes to sentencing for violent crimes, the white experience in Texas is, even now, I know, very different from the black experience in Texas. But here we're talking about an event that happened in 1989, and those differences could only ever be magnified by the different race situation back then. So we do have to ask ourselves, would a different jury have legitimately come to a different conclusion in Philip Tompkins' case?
In this episode, we've explored the letters of Philip Tompkins. We've looked at issues surrounding a claim of accidental homicide.
I did recklessly cause the death of someone, but the person's death was accidentally reckless, not intentionally done.
We've discussed culpability and responsibility when an individual is convicted of murder despite the murderer claiming that the death of his victim was accidental.
I did not intend to kill the person.
We've heard about pen pals and how we're not the only people writing to inmates in the US.
I call them my angels, and they are.
And finally, we've discussed issues of race and jury selection, and how this can have an impact on the conviction of a man who claims he was innocent.
It don't make sense to me that a person hates someone because he is black or white.
Philip Tompkins spent 40 years in prison before he died of coronavirus complications in 2020. In his letters to us, he doesn't deny the crime of kidnapping and robbery, but we will never know if the death that he caused was accidental or deliberate.
And we can only speculate that the outcome of his trial may have been different if the members of the jury themselves had been different people. Ultimately, however, it's only through raising awareness of stories like these that justice itself can be scrutinised and served.
Next time on Letters from a Killer. The unlikely vigilante.
I stood in front of Daniel's house just looking. All the thoughts came flooding back to me, all the things my son had said repeatedly. Don't remember exactly when, but I lit the flare and threw it and ran. Setting their house on fire was the only thing that was supposed to happen. Taking a life was never my intention at all.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker, and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.